This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
They're really passionate about what they do. They love bees. That's why they're doing it. You don't become a beekeeper to make money.
Back in 2010, we had entomologist John Hafernick on Sea Change Radio to explain what was going on with the honeybees and colony collapse disorder. Today's guest, Hannah Nordhaus, picks up where Dr. Hafernick left off with her new book, The Beekeeper's Lament. In the book, she profiles an industrial beekeeper, examines the close tie between almond cultivation and the honeybee population, and details the current research on colony collapse disorder. Later on in the show, I speak with the founders of a new company called Earthstarter, who've developed an easier way to grow your own food that can turn even an inattentive gardener into a successful producer of fruits, vegetables, and complementary flowers. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by author and writer, my old friend Hannah Nordhaus. Hannah, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi there, Alex. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Last time we talked, you were working on a book called The Beekeeper's Lament, and that's since been a national bestseller, and you built this off of an article that you wrote for the High Country News about John Miller. Maybe you can give us a little backstory on the research that went into The Beekeeper's Lament.
So I met this guy, John Miller, in, I think it was in 2004, when I wrote an article for a Natural Foods magazine about a company called Honey Stinger that makes like honey-based energy gels. And he was one of the founders of this company. And I interviewed all the different founders. When I got to him, I ended up talking to him for like an hour and a half about bees and honey. And John Miller has 10,000 beehives. He might have even more now. He's trying to, his goal, he says, is global domination of the honeybee world. So he has 10,000 beehives, and he hauls them all over the country from California to Washington State and then up to North Dakota, pollinating crops and making honey. And when I met him, I had no idea that there was such a profession and that modern agriculture was so dependent on honeybee pollination. So I just started keeping in touch with him, and over the course of 3 years, followed him around the Central Valley of California and went up to Gackle, North Dakota, where he has his summer digs, and just kept in touch with him and ended up writing this article for High Country News in 2007. And the article came out about 2 months after this strange new disorder called colony collapse first surfaced in the nation's newspapers. John Miller actually had not lost a lot of bees to colony collapse disorder at the time I wrote the article, but a lot of his colleagues had, and he'd lost a lot of bees to all sorts of other diseases, pests, and pathogens. So the article was really about how tough it is to be a beekeeper these days and how important these migratory beekeepers are to our food system.
So even though they're called honeybees, the real cash crop from being a beekeeper is pollinating almond trees, correct?
Yes, you could call them almond bees.
Almond bees, right.
Yeah, that's how they make their money. But it's really a Faustian bargain for them because they bring these bees into the almonds in California. They 2/3 of the nation's bees come in, almost like 2 million hives, haul them all in. They're all sitting very close to each other in the Central Valley, swapping spit, as John Miller, my beekeeper, likes to say, and trading diseases. It's been compared to a giant brothel. They just come, they bring all their nasty stuff, and then they go back home and bring all the nasty stuff they caught back to the bees that haven't traveled to California. And so it's really become this huge vector for all sorts of diseases and disorders.
Give our listeners a quick overview of the arc of this colony collapse disorder from a science perspective.
Sure, yeah. So the first time that I ever heard of colony collapse disorder was in the spring of 2007. The New York Times ran a front page story, I think, in February of that year. And I had been working on this story about John Miller, so I was really attuned to what was going on. and knew that there that honeybees had been suffering. But my focus at that point was really on the varroa mite, which is this nasty little tick that latches onto the honeybees and sort of sucks the life out of first the bee, then the hive, then entire bee yards and honeybee operations. And in 2004, there had been a big die-off, and John Miller lost 60% of his bees that year, and he blamed it on the varroa mite. He thought it was some sort of viral event that had been vectored by this varroa mite, which brings lots of other diseases and weakens bees so that they're susceptible to stuff. And so I was writing about that. But then as I was wrapping up this article, colony collapse disorder hit the news. And it really, the first time anybody noticed it was, and gave it a name, was in 2006, in the fall of 2006, a beekeeper named Dave Hackenberg, who's based in Pennsylvania, lost a bunch of bees while they were in Florida. He winters in Florida with his bees. And they had just flown off. And they left their queen behind, which bees don't do. And there was plenty of honey, and there was plenty of brood, which are the baby bees that are about to hatch. And they're just gone. And so in 2006, it was named fall dwindle disease. And then by 2007, when it became clear that this was a bigger thing, they renamed it colony collapse disorder. And in 2007 and 2008, a lot of beekeepers lost bees. In strange ways that couldn't be explained. It's hard to diagnose because the bees disappear, but there definitely seemed like there was some virulent kind of thing happening. And since then, beekeepers have been losing approximately 30% of the national herd each year. The big losses, typically, before all this happened, it was 8 to 15% was considered normal losses each year. And now they're losing about a third each year. But it's not always because of colony collapse. And that's something that has really frustrated me. It's a real confusion in the media and among even honeybee advocates that every time a bee dies, people think it's colony collapse disorder. But in fact, if colony collapse disorder is still going on, it's very low levels, but bees are dying from all sorts of other horrible things still, and it's beekeepers are really struggling to keep their bees alive and to keep pollinating our crops and making our honey.
So after researching and writing about this mystery disorder for so many years, are you hopeful that there are solutions in sight, and are we going to have a healthy, thriving bee population in a decade or so, in your opinion?
I do not know. In terms of what colony collapse disorder is, there's a lot of theories. The one that's gained the most traction is that it's caused by these new systemic pesticides called neonicotinoids. I've been following this for a long time, and I'm not persuaded that that's the case. And people get very mad at me when I say that because it's an easy solution. It's has this nice sort of environmental narrative about it that
it's easy to say, right?
It's a little hard to pronounce, but it's easy to say it's pesticides. That's the problem. And if we get rid of pesticides, the problem will go away. And there's this whole silent spring kind of we humans are destroying nature and all we have to do is stop making pesticides and it will be better. And I just don't think that's the case.
And isn't there a quote, is it Einstein? I forget who it was. So once the bees die, then we're toast, basically. Maybe it's Oscar Wilde or something.
If the honeybee were to die, then humans would have no more than 4 years to live, which there's no record Einstein ever said that.
Right.
Nor is it true.
Okay. It's one of those falsely attributed things.
So, our diet would suck. We definitely have a much less diverse, colorful diet, but we'd still be eating. And there were no honeybees in North America. Honeybees aren't native to North America. There were no honeybees here before the pilgrims came over in the 1620s. So,
really? So they're not native to this?
They're not native.
Are these European bees then that we have here in the state?
Yeah, European bees. They're naturalized. They've been here a long time. They've gone feral, but there is no such thing as wild honeybees. They weren't here in the wild.
And what about almond trees?
Not native either. And so, the whole system is sort of this human imposed system. But nonetheless, we eat the stuff. We want the stuff. I like almonds. I like cherries, berries, melons, all the things that bees pollinate. So we want them around. So in terms of, the colony collapse disorder, I you know, they're probably these neonicotinoids and other pesticides. I mean, there were before neonicotinoids, there were even worse pesticides. The issue with neonicotinoids is they're sort of they seem to have a longer life and may do damage at chronic low levels. That it's not just like you spray pesticides and you kill all the bees. It's that they're accumulating it in their systems and in their honey and pollen, and perhaps it's causing them to be vulnerable to other things. And that may, in fact, be the case. It probably is a factor. But, you know, as I mentioned, with the almond pollination, the sort of globalization of the honeybee and how, and they're so mobile now and they're part of our agricultural system. And so there are so many other stresses on them besides pesticides. And the varroa mite, which I mentioned earlier, I think is really the most insidious and destructive. And I think if they can figure out a way to deal with the varroa mite, then in 10 years, the honeybee will probably be in okay shape.
Are we talking about just North America? And this is a global issue, right?
Yeah, especially the varroa mite. It's a global issue. And one thing with the pesticides, and people will disagree with me, this is something, it's a very emotional issue. You know, they've banned these neonicotinoids in parts of Europe. Bees aren't doing any better there. They don't have, they use plenty of neonicotinoids in Australia where they don't have the varroa mite, and bees are doing pretty well there. I mean, not, you still hear of die-offs and you hear of pesticide kills, but in general, the bees in Australia, and they also don't have quite as intensive agricultural work in Australia, so you can't really compare apples to apples, but they're doing better. And they have neonicotinoids, they don't have the varroa mite. So there's nothing that leaps out at me is like, if we do this, we're going to solve colony collapse disorder, except for this varroa mite. I think that's really, you know, it may not solve colony collapse disorder, but if we find a way to deal with the varroa mite besides what they use now, which is miticide, you know, poisons they put into the hive, which weaken the bees, they'll have a much healthier bees and an easier time keeping them alive and staying in business.
My sleeves have come unstitched from climbing your tree. When dogs laugh, some say they're barking, but don't think they're mean. Some people get so frightened, the fences in between.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to author and writer Hannah Nordhaus. Her latest book is The Beekeeper's Lament. So as a writer, you're not just documenting the work of John Miller and the plight of the modern honeybee. You obviously wanted to craft a narrative and create a story out of this that was more compelling than just reading a science journal. What made John Miller such an attractive subject for you?
Well, John Miller, he's just a wonderful character. He's incredibly eloquent. He's really funny. And he's so passionate about what he does. And so in many ways, yeah, I'm interested in honeybees, but I knew nothing about bees when I started this project. I was a science and environmental journalist, but I wasn't into bugs, but I met John Miller. And so he was, you know, personally, he was the one who made me realize that honeybees were really interesting. And I thought, you know, as I worked on this article about him, I realized that he was just this wonderful guide into this whole world that I knew nothing about and that many of my readers knew nothing about. And he's just such a good storyteller, and he has this great history. He's a fourth generation beekeeper. His great grandfather is considered the father of migratory beekeeping. He was the first person to he took his bees from Utah on a train and hauled them to California to make honey in the wintertime when everything was dormant in Utah. And so there's this history there that was really intriguing. And honeybees themselves are so sort of metaphorically rich. So it was just, it was a way for me to explore a world that I knew nothing about. And I mean, I think if John Miller was a race car driver, I would have written a book about that. I mean, he just is a really good character to hang this narrative on, and to try to make bees and what's happening to the bees and sort of the environmental story behind it, the news story, and then the science part of it a little bit more accessible to readers.
You write about how in the Central Valley of California, you can immediately tell almond farmers from farmers of other crops because their houses are really nice, and it's been a pretty lucrative business as the almond industry has exploded. It's been they're not only tasty, but and it's an important ingredient in our a more and more important ingredient in our diet. Now, concurrently, have the beekeepers flourished financially during this boom for the almond business, or are they suffering because of colony collapse disorder?
Yeah, I think they're just sort of holding their own. And so the almond, as I mentioned before, it's a curse and a blessing. They're making more money in this 3-week period than, you know, they make like $150 to $200 a hive. So yeah, so let's say he's making a lot of money, but it's expensive to keep your hives alive these days. There's a lot of inputs, so a lot of equipment. A lot of, you have to feed them sugar water, corn syrup. He does sugar water in the times when stuff isn't blooming because he's moving around. He has to get them into the almond orchards before it blooms. Gets there, it's a desert. There's nothing blooming. And then there's this 3-week period where it blooms and they're going crazy. Then he has to get them out of there because there's nothing for them to eat. They're going to get sprayed with pesticides or fungicides and go to the next place, which also isn't in bloom. And so he has to pay all this money to keep them alive in between the blooms. And then, because bees are so unhealthy these days, there's the medicines they have to put in there. There's gas, there's employees. So there's a lot of inputs. And with the high levels of losses in recent years, every hive that you lose to replace it is about $60. So that's, they're putting in a lot more money to keep their numbers up. But they are able to do it. So, and you know, one sort of common fallacy is that the honeybees are dying and we're going to be out of honeybees in 4 years. In fact, the number of hives in the country has stayed stable since I've been working on this subject, because there's more money. Those people who have the big losses have enough money because of the pollination fees, because of the almond money, to put it back in and recoup their losses.
Were you as inspired by getting to know all these beekeepers, and or was it a little daunting to see these big ag and monocultures so dependent on this very fragile species?
I love these big bee guys because, just like the little bee guys, they're really passionate about what they do. They love bees. That's why they're doing it. You don't become a beekeeper to make money, because there's just not enough money. You get stung. There's so many hassles. It's not something like, I want to make $1 million. I'm going to keep bees. It's just not something you do. These guys are doing it. Most of them are second or third or fourth generation beekeepers. They have a tradition that they care about, and they love bees. So they participate in a system that can be quite appalling. And they know that, and they're aware of that, and they know it's hurting their bees, and they know that it's ultimately, you know, not the healthiest way to eat, but this is sort of what they're locked into. So they are given a hard time by the smaller, sort of more organic type beekeepers who feel like they are part of the problem. I mean, I do think they are part of the problem, but I also think that they're doing everything they can to keep bees healthy. And this varroa mite that I keep mentioning, it arrived in the US in 1987 and pretty much knocked out every feral beehive in the country. So every wild, you know, bees that are living in trees randomly in the forest got killed by this varroa mite. And there are some surviving populations. But the only reason there are any honeybees really in the US now is because of beekeepers. And so they're doing their best to take care of bees. And what I tell this, the smaller scale beekeepers who, you know, I buy their honey, I love what they do, they are not going to be the people who keep this modern agricultural system that we have going. And so I envision this two-tiered system, or there is now a two-tiered system where you have these these people who have the luxury of being able to experiment and let all their bees die. And then you have guys like John Miller who are on this treadmill of trying to keep up with the latest diseases and pesticide problems. And they're going to have to coexist. And the big bee guys aren't great for the little bee guys. I think the little bee guys are very good for the big bee guys, but that's just sort of, that's the world we live in.
She's the author of The Beekeeper's Lament. People can go to hannahnordhaus.com to learn more about it. Hannah Nordhaus, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
That was lots of fun. Thanks, Alex.
I'm a king bee, buzzing around your hive. I'm a king bee, jolly, buzzing around your hive. I can make honey, baby. Let me fly up on inside.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
Next on Sea Change Radio, I'm joined by Phil Weiner and John Gorby. They're the founders of Earthstarter, and their new product is called NourishMat. John and Phil, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having us, Alex.
Phil, first give us an overview of this new product, NourishMat. What does it do, and where do you see the need for something like this?
Sure. So first, our mission is just to turn consumers into producers. And the whole idea is that we want to help city dwellers or people with small spaces grow their own food and flowers. And the problem is, for a lot of folks, they either lack the gardening knowledge, they don't have a lot of time, and they think they don't have enough space to start a garden. So when we designed the NourishMat, we knew that it had to be an affordable solution, something that was easy to use, and that we couldn't just leave the user, that we had to pack it with resources as well. So all you have to do is lay a 4-foot by 6-foot NourishMat down onto any healthy soil area, comes with built-in irrigation, plug it right into the hose, and then you take any one of the 19 plant types that come in the form of 82 pre-planted seed balls, place them right in each labeled planting square, and voila, you can sit back, relax, and grow natural food in your own yard.
So John, we're looking at a twister-like mat with holes in it.
Yeah, a lot of people confuse it for a game board or dominoes, but it's a white weed barrier with irrigation built into it. It kind of has a feel of a game board, like you said, but what we really wanted to do was create a multi-sensory learning product to allow kids and adults to visually see and understand where plants are located and why they're located next to each other. So we've integrated our product to have companion planting, square foot gardening methods, as Phil said, as well as an educational curriculum to educate the users on why plants are placed next to each other, why we've designated certain colors to certain squares, and really just made it a fun, easy, understandable way to start and grow your own food.
Where do you see NourishMats being most embraced, in a city environment, in a rural environment? And do you see this being a solution for small farmers in developing countries?
Absolutely. The NourishMat is really great for the urban dweller, the person that has small, limited space, either in a condo setting. Maybe you can go to your landlord and talk to them about setting up a small space outside for the residents of your community or condo to kind of get involved with this kind of this outreach gardening kind of thing that's catching on. We also can print and cut and label these mats in any kind of form in any language. So we feel that there's a really big potential for overseas and helping in foreign aid and education with food and limited resources with people that don't have the knowledge or the tools to get started.
And it looks like a pretty low-tech
concept. It's just a mat with some, you know, lettuce, tomato, marigolds written out with holes punched in where you'd put your planting bulbs. But there's more to it than that. Why don't you walk us through a little bit of the technology behind it?
Sure. So we did want to keep it simple. So once you take it out of the packaging and you lay it onto the ground, the instructions are right there for you to understand what to do next. There is a north and south arrow on the mat that helps you orient the mat, the nourish mat, in the proper directions to get full sun exposure. And at the base of the mat, there's also a male or a female connection hose to allow you to hook up to any normal garden hose that you might have in your condo or house, or easily accessible to you. The irrigation is woven throughout the mat to allow water to be distributed to each of those spaces. So you don't have to worry about watering or spending a lot of time focusing all your energy on watering or getting it right then. All the holes are spaced appropriately to allow each plant to have enough room to grow up through the mat and not overwhelm any one space. And you use succession planting to allow multiple planting and harvesting throughout one year or multiple growing seasons.
And the irrigation distribution seems to be one of the more tricky things technologically that you had to develop. Is that fair to say?
It is. I mean, we had to make sure that we got all the angles correct while we were weaving the hose. Right now it's all manually woven, and attached to the mat, but it basically just drips and weeps water from the irrigation, which is then soaked up from the mat material itself and then slowly released into the ground, watering your plant roots.
So there's like a hose inside this, basically, that distributes it accordingly?
Yeah, the hose isn't inside, but it's actually, it's woven so that most of the hose is underneath the material, which keeps water under the mat and on the ground instead of being evaporated into the air. So you don't lose water from evaporation, and it actually allows you to conserve 80% of your water that you would normally use or spend on a traditional garden.
Have you been able to see this literally through its fruition and eat the harvest from a nourish mat?
We have. It's actually really good.
How much food does it produce? It
produces about 25 to 30 pounds of food in a single season for a new user. For a experienced gardener, they can do what John mentioned, which is called succession planting. So if I start my nourish mat in spring, I have my seed balls that it comes with. I plant all my spring crops. Within about 30 days, I may get some radishes. I can then harvest those radishes and plant another plant right down that space based on our recommendations that are in our planting guide and website.
So you have a pest control system that's a little different than using pesticides.
Yes, so we've got two forms of pest control integrated within the garden itself and the seed balls. So the unique thing about the seed balls is that they protect the seeds from rodents. So your average robin redbreast is actually one of the smartest birds because it follows humans and is very accustomed to just going right behind you and picking up your seeds. The seed balls have chili powder inside. It's a mixture of clay, earthworm castings, the chili powder to keep away pests, and most importantly, non-GMO seeds. And that's all integrated within a companion planting method. So for instance, the marigolds next to the tomatoes. Why? Well, the bugs that like marigolds are the same bugs that love to eat the bugs that love to eat tomatoes. So companion planting is extremely important for, one, introducing pollinators and introducing biodiversity. So the more you have one crop in one area, the more you'll find one bug that loves to eat that one crop. So by having different plants there means that we can have different bugs that'll fight each other off.
The product is Nourish Mat, and they are John Gorby and Phil Weiner. Gentlemen, thanks for being my guests on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
Thanks, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Hugh Masekela, Wilco, and the Grateful Dead.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.